It's my pleasure to welcome Dr. Claire Montaliani to our Yahoo Machine Learning Seminar this week. Claire is a research faculty in the Center for Computational Learning Systems and adjunct faculty in the Department of Computer Science at Columbia University in the city of New York, in case you didn't know. Prior to joining Columbia, she was a postdoc in the Computer Science and Engineering Department at the University of California, San Diego. She completed her PhD and Master's in Computer Science at MIT. So that was in computer science, and she did her undergraduate work in Earth and Planetary Sciences, very relevant to us, at Harvard University. Her research focus is in machine learning theory and algorithms, in particular learning from data streams, clustering, active learning, and privacy-preserving machine learning. She has recently started working on climate informatics, accelerating discovery in climate science and machine learning. Her work in this area has received the Best Application Paper Award and has been presented at an expert meeting of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, a panel formed by the UN that shared the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize. Very nice. Thank you, Cliff.
Thanks so much, Gina, and thanks for inviting me. Just to give you a bit of a background on my research agenda, I'm really inspired by the fact that we're facing an explosion in the amount of data sources and the amount of data that's being generated. I'm sure everyone in this room can think of a lot of data from some source. Certainly, anytime you do anything on the internet, a trail of data is created, and this is only increasing with social computing. Biological applications have been creating a large amount of data, and there's also a lot of data being generated from environmental applications and just satellite monitoring and imaging that's being continually recorded. So when we go to design machine learning algorithms to learn from this data, we really have to face some of the problems, attributes, or characteristics about real-world data and take those into account. So not only is there a lot of data, sometimes the data can be extremely high-dimensional. It can be noisy or raw, meaning that parts of it may be corrupted or missing. Some data is actually sparse, in that even though you record a very high-resolution image, for example, the relevant information might be in a much lower-dimensional subspace. Some data is streaming, arriving over time, or even varying with time. And some data is actually sensitive or private. It might be medical records of individuals, for example. So my goal is to design machine learning algorithms to learn from real data sources, tackling some of these fundamental challenges. Now let's just get on the same page with what we mean by machine learning, right? This is an umbrella term for many families of algorithms, but standard batch supervised learning typically entails that you're given a batch of labeled data ahead of time. So that's the batch part, and the labeled part is why we would call it supervised learning. This is very, very general. You could think, for example, of a medical database where each point is representing one patient's medical record. And say you've taken 10 medical tests on each patient, so each point lives in 10-dimensional Euclidean space if these tests, say hemoglobin levels, et cetera, have real valued outputs. And now you want to find a classification rule and say the label is the diagnosis, yes, no, for a particular disease. Now you'd like to find a classification rule that describes the data well and also generalizes to new data. So for example, if you're trying to find a linear classification rule, you might fit this as your disease classifier. And then if a new patient comes in and you take their 10 medical tests and they end up here, then, you know, with some probability, you might predict that their diagnosis is going to be red or, you know, positive for that particular disease. But really, this is widely, widely applicable, and I just wanted to get on the same page with terminology for what we mean by standard batch supervised machine learning. But what I'm interested in doing is design machine learning algorithms to learn from real data sources, addressing now some of those challenges that change the problem. And I'm interested in algorithms that are practical and have good performance, but for which we can also prove some performance guarantees. So some of the complications of real data that I've studied are streaming data, raw or unlabeled data, for which I've studied active learning and clustering, private data, such as I mentioned medical records and those sorts of data belonging to individuals. And I'm also interested in applying machine learning to new interesting applications. And one that I'm particularly excited about these days is climate informatics, which is applications to climate science. So what I'm going to do this morning is I'm going to have two parts. In the first part, I'm going to give you an overview of the sorts of algorithms that I've worked on for learning from real data sources and the types of theoretical contributions I've made there. And then in the second part of the talk, I'm going to talk about a specific application, climate informatics, and we'll also talk about a learning algorithm there and its application. So first, let me motivate what I mean by learning from data streams. So there's a fair amount of data, such as stock prices, that does sort of accumulate in a streaming manner. You might want to make buy-sell decisions to manage your financial portfolio based on predicting changing stock prices. And this is also true with weather data and other sorts of data that arrives in a streaming manner. Sometimes the labels arrive in a streaming manner. So now if the learning algorithm is in a spam filter, and you would like this learning algorithm, the spam filter, to adjust to your preferences for spam or not spam, you as the human user are only going to occasionally label messages junk or not junk, and so this learning algorithm has to do classification in an online or streaming manner. Sometimes the data itself is not streaming, but you're learning on a sensor or a mobile device or a handheld device that really has some memory constraints that require you to access a batch of finite data in a streaming manner. So in contrast to the picture I showed you in the supervised batch learning setting, in the streaming setting, you receive points one at a time and sort of update your classifier. And let me describe what I mean exactly by the model. So the data access mechanism is this stream. You can think of this maybe as the reading head of a Turing machine, but that can only move in one direction. So you can either think of the head moving along past the data or the data moving past the head. And by that, I mean that we're considering the constraint that the data access mechanism is one-at-a-time data access. So you might see, once you see a data point, you might not see it again in the stream. And in some problems, you also care about making real-time predictions. And this models these forecasting and real-time decision-making problems that I motivated. Now, without adding any further constraints to the problem, one could certainly just use batch learning. Sit around, wait until you've seen a lot of data points in the stream, and then run standard batch supervised learning. Firstly, there's quite a literature on batch supervised learning, so there wouldn't be that much open work to do. But also, we really would like our solutions to match the form of the problem a little bit. So we also add this second constraint that any computation that the algorithm does per observation, and also the memory used, should not grow with the number of data observations seen since the beginning of time. So you can't do what I previously suggested. And this models resource-constrained learning, but even if you're not on a very resource-constrained device, any machine learning algorithm is going to be run on a computer, and by virtue of that, it will have resource constraints. So this is, in general, what I study when I study learning from data streams, and that has categorized a large portion of my research. I'm going to talk about online learning, which is supervised learning from infinite data streams, when I talk about the climate informatics application. And I'm really interested now in the intersection of learning from data streams and learning from raw or unlabeled data. So I've also worked on active learning, some of it in the data stream setting, and streaming clustering. So let me mention what I mean by those. So I'm going to talk about two methods for learning from raw or unlabeled data. So most of the data is not labeled for any particular classification task. So imagine in computer vision you would like to train an algorithm to do face recognition from pictures or video. Well, you can find plenty of pictures on the web, but most of them are not conveniently labeled as to where the faces are. Similarly, if you would like to train a speech recognition algorithm, you can hold up a microphone anywhere and collect plenty of speech data. It just hasn't been labeled with words or phonemes unless you pay someone, you know, to sit down and transcribe it. So the idea here is that given that most data originates unlabeled, and labels for any particular classification task are expensive in terms of being time-consuming to compute, or you actually have to pay a cost to attain them. Can we give the algorithm the power to choose which unlabeled data it would like to pay for labels on? And by doing so, could we get by with many fewer labeled data points for learning by giving that power to the learning algorithm? So in this setting, you hope to learn to a fixed accuracy that uses fewer labels than if you were in the supervised learning model where all the data must be labeled. So again, to contrast the scenario to the first picture I gave you of FAFSA supervised learning, you would either have a stream or a pool of unlabeled data, and the algorithm would choose which points to label, and you still want to get a good classifier. Now, just to motivate why you might be able to use fewer labels than in the supervised learning setting, suppose I know that my data should be linearly separable. Would I need to pay for a label on this point at this stage? Probably not, right? Because any linear classifier that is consistent with these labels would label it green. And here's another simple setting where drastic savings have been shown. So if we know that our data just lives on the line in one-dimensional Euclidean space, and we know that it's perfectly separable by some threshold W, such that points to the right of W have the positive label and points to the left of W have a negative label, then standard supervised learning theory shows that if you want to achieve error rate at most epsilon, which is the expected error on some fixed data distribution, then you need 1 over epsilon labeled examples from that distribution. And these need to be sampled independently and identically. This is the IID setting. So let's consider an IID setting for active learning, where you can take 1 over epsilon samples from your data distribution. Now, to find the closest pair of points that differ in label is just a binary search. Why is that? So any point that I label, so if it comes up red, because I know it's perfectly separable by some threshold, then I know all the points to the left of it are red, and I can infer that without paying for those labels. Similarly, if a point comes up green, I know all points to the right of it are green. So I just do a binary search to find the closest pair of labels, and now I can perfectly classify 1 over epsilon points.
But yeah? We are deciding on incrementally. We are asking
yes.
for one point, then asking
yes.
for the other.
Active learning is typically incremental. That's a very good point. Thanks. So now I can perfectly classify 1 over epsilon points. These points were IID from the distribution, which means my error rate on the distribution is at most epsilon. But I've only made log of the number of unlabeled points queries, so I've made log 1 over epsilon label requests. This is an exponential improvement against supervised learning. Unfortunately, this was then followed by a series of negative results, because this is a very simple case, and other cases were studied for which there were some negative results. And I'm just going to give you a high-level taste of some of my contributions in this area. So the first question you might wonder about is, can you generalize this notion of binary search to high dimension and still yield exponential label savings? And so we had one of the first positive results in active learning theory in a while that showed for linear separators in d-dimensional Euclidean space, we gave an active learning algorithm that actually worked in the online or infinite data stream setting that needed d log 1 over epsilon labels to converge to error epsilon, in contrast to the supervised sample complexity, which is d over epsilon. So again, it was an exponential improvement. And we also bounded a new quantity, which is errors that the learner made, even if it didn't pay for the label, to know that it was an error. So this was a very positive first step, but again, it was only for linear separators, which is a particular type of classifier. And it was actually with respect to the uniform distribution. So then I posed an open problem as to whether it was possible to do general active learning, meaning any sorts of classifiers could be considered, and there could be any data distribution. The only assumption was that you had IID samples from the data distribution. And more generally, is there a reduction from active learning to supervised learning? So then we provided the first reduction from active learning to supervised learning. And so what we can show is that the number of labels you request is never worse than the normal supervised learning sample complexity, but you can get significant savings for various distribution and classifier pairs. And in terms of efficiency, if you have an efficient algorithm for the supervised learning task, this is a polylog reduction, so it's not that much worse. It's still efficient to run active learning. Let me just give you a schematic of what it would mean to do a reduction from active learning to supervised learning. So here's your active learning algorithm. It's trying to learn the particular classifier for the task, say, you know, the model for a disease, for example. But it needs to do so by minimizing the number of label queries. So given an unlabeled data point, it can either pay to ask for a label or simply not ask. Well, it should only ask for a label if it's uncertain, okay? So the idea is we'll use access to a supervised learning algorithm for the problem to determine certainty. So for example, if you're doing binary classification, you can hallucinate the two possible labels, you know, +1 and -1 for the current point, and then run supervised learning with all the previously labeled examples and the current point with the hallucinated label. So you call the supervised learner twice, and then you compare the hypotheses returned. And you only want to request a label to disambiguate between them. If one has much higher error rate than the other on some labeled holdout set, then you can infer what the value of the label is without paying for it. So that's the overall idea of this reduction. And it allowed us to be very general. So now the data distribution could be arbitrary. The data didn't even have to be separable with respect to that particular type of classifier, and it would handle any type of classifier. The assumption here, though, still is IID. So giving you now a taste of clustering, I'm going to move on. Oh, yeah?
So I have a question about the active learning.
Yeah.
So this model will also work in cases where the learner has multiple labels for one instance, and it's deciding whether I should get another label for this instance to reduce my uncertainty, or whether I should get a new label for a brand new instance.
Oh. There might be a way to extend it. Not necessarily directly,
okay,
but let's chat about it in our
okay
meeting. That's cool. So here, in clustering, the picture is we don't have labels, and we can't even pay for them. You know, what can we do just simply in the setting where there's no labels? And this is called unsupervised learning. And one unsupervised learning task that is widely used is clustering, where you simply partition your data in some way that summarizes it to be helpful for applications. Generally speaking, though, clustering algorithms are hard to evaluate. First off, how many clusters should I have for a given data set? That's called choosing K, the number of clusters, and it's pretty open, and it's something I haven't worked on. But even if someone tells me that K is 3 here and I need to find 3 clusters, which cluster should they be? Okay? So some ways that you might want to evaluate them, if you are working with a particular data set, say you're clustering medical images of tumors, then you could show them to a doctor, someone who's a domain expert for that kind of data, and see if they like how the clusters look. But generally speaking, when you don't want to have a human in the loop and you would like clustering algorithms that apply to many different applications where you don't have to know the application beforehand, then you can't do that. So another thing that people have done is the following. If they're trying to fit, say, 3 clusters, they analyze how well their algorithm does if the data actually was generated by, say, 3 Gaussians. Okay, so there's a lot of work on that. But for the rest of the talk, I really want to throw away any data assumptions. So first off, I don't want to assume my data came from K or 3 Gaussians. And in fact, I don't even want to assume that my data is IID. I don't want to make any data assumptions for the rest of the talk. So in that setting, one thing you can do to evaluate clustering algorithms is write down some sensible objective that you would like your clustering algorithm to achieve. And a widely cited one for clustering is called the k-means clustering objective. So here, the data that you want to cluster is in Euclidean space. And you want to output a set of clusters, we call them C, cluster centers, of size K. And this set just has to be in Euclidean space. It doesn't have to be a subset of the input data points. And your goal should be to minimize this k-means cost of your set of centers C on data set X. You just sum over the data set X the L2 squared distance of each point X to its closest center C in your set C. So this is just something reasonable that you might want a clustering to achieve when you're clustering data in Euclidean space. Unfortunately, you can't optimize it directly. That's been shown to be NP-hard even for small k. And so then you might want to approximate it. And so an approximation algorithm for the k-means objective, a b-approximation algorithm, is defined as follows. For any input set of points x, the algorithm will output a set of centers c such that the k-means cost of c on x is at most b, some constant, times the optimal value of the k-means objective on that point set x. And then you can also talk about a bicriteria approximation algorithm, which is b approximate with respect to the objective, and outputs at most ak centers. So it might output more than k centers, but at most a times k. Even with these notions, however, there aren't that many algorithms that approximate the k-means objective. Even though this objective is widely justified for the design of algorithms, in fact, there's an algorithm called the k-means clustering algorithm that has no approximation guarantees with respect to that objective. You may have seen this algorithm around. It's essentially hard assignment EM, hard assignment expectation maximization is a quick way to describe it. And generally, I refer to it as Lloyd's algorithm to disambiguate from the k-means objective, which it does not optimize. It has generally been shown to converge quickly in practice, but the optima that's reached has no guarantees with respect to the global optimum. And actually, now there's a lower bound that shows some instances for which it runs takes exponential time. And usually the problem when it doesn't converge well is bad initialization. But one relatively recent positive result is the algorithm called K-means++, which is B approximate, and B is O log K. So you might be a little bit frustrated that B is a function of K, but again, there's so little literature on this that this was an important positive result. Okay? So some work that I've been involved in was to approximate the K-means objective in the streaming setting. So that previous result was in the batch setting. And so first we start, in the results that I'm reporting here, we were in the finite data stream setting. So this is still important if you just want to make only a constant number of passes of your data set, and in our solution, actually, you only make one pass. So we still care about lightweight algorithms, but the data set is finite. So the ideas here were, so first we noticed that there's this algorithm, and this is just in the batch setting before we talk about the streaming solution, that is a B-approximate algorithm with respect to k-means, where B is O log k, and it returns exactly k-centers. So the idea was, can we design a variant, and this would entail a new analysis, and we'll call this algorithm k-means sharp, such that the approximation of the objective is now constant, but the approximation of k is with factor O log k. Okay, so we can output at most OK log k centers, but we have a constant approximation to the k-means objective. The second idea was to extend a streaming clustering technique with respect that has approximation guarantees with respect to a different clustering objective to k-means, and then use some of our batch results in that. I'll get to that in a second. So this was also a contribution to batch clustering. And so that's what we showed. With sufficient probability, we provided this algorithm and an analysis such that it outputs at most OK log K centers, but it approximates the objective by a constant. And then we also had to extend the analysis of this streaming divide and conquer clustering to the k-means objective, and we showed that given two batch k-means clustering algorithms, one that's, say, A-B approximate and the other that's A prime B prime approximate, this streaming framework yields a bicriteria approximation of this form, A prime OBB prime. So then all we have to do is apply our batch clustering algorithms appropriately with a choice of A, B, A prime, and B prime, to in the end actually yield a B approximate clustering algorithm, where B is O log K. So our value of A prime is 1, so we output exactly K centers. So the punchline on this work is that we match the K-means plus result in the streaming setting. So I'm just going to give people a quick taste of my work on privacy-preserving machine learning, just one slide, and then we're going to move on to the climate application. So now the problem is that the data itself, it belongs to private individuals, such as financial records or medical records. And this is increasingly what statisticians or data analysts are facing in the wild. But there'd be social value to still learning from this data. So, for example, an epidemiologist might want to learn a classifier for a disease and publish the classifier. But you wouldn't want doing so to somehow violate the privacy of the individuals whose health records were used to learn that classifier. So I've, with a co-author, I've helped to establish this area of privacy-preserving machine learning, where we simultaneously want to prove that our algorithms are private with respect to strong privacy protocols coming from the cryptography community. In particular, we have currently been working with respect to the Epsilon differential privacy model. Yet, provide learning performance guarantees that are desirable for the learning aspect of the algorithm. And so, at a very high level, we have... So essentially, this requires going and revisiting each family of machine learning algorithm and revisiting it and perhaps adapting it and reanalyzing it with respect to privacy. So we've done so for a family of machine learning algorithms called regularized empirical risk minimization algorithms, ERM. And this subsumes support vector machine and logistic regression. And we also have a general result for how to tune parameters of any algorithm in a privacy-preserving way. So now, after giving you a taste of contributions in algorithms, I'm going to jump into this application that I'm really excited about. So first, I just recognize that there are many open and pressing questions in climate science, some of which really have potential to be very impactful to society, for example, if there's climate change happening. And we know that machine learning can really accelerate discovery in other fields. So, for example, you know, bioinformatics was a real marriage of data mining, machine learning, and statistics with biology that has led to a lot of discoveries. So the idea would be to have a similar effect on climate science by applying machine learning. But we've also noticed that it's a two-way street. We've started on some of these collaborations, and they actually open up some interesting new machine learning problems that might suggest the design of new algorithms that are open problems in the machine learning literature. So I just wanted to quickly show you this. I'm not going to go through all these works, but it's a burgeoning field. I found that there are some collaborations here and there, and I'm actually trying to bring the community together on this, and I'm holding the first climate informatics workshop in New York City this summer, and so if people are interested, I can keep you posted about that. I personally have so far only worked on a collaboration in climate modeling, which is one of the areas of climate science, and so let me motivate that now. So what is a climate model? For all you machine learning and data mining people in the audience, these are not data-driven models, okay? They are actually mathematical models based on first scientific principles. So what you have is a component model for each possible process in the atmosphere, such as clouds forming, sea ice melting, advection. Each of those is a differential equation with some reaction rate that is considered to be based on a first principle in one of these sciences. And then there's some parameterized way that they interact that is also based on, you know, a mathematical model. So it's in some sense this very complex system of interacting mathematical models where each mathematical model models some process in the atmosphere or ocean. And then they're discretized over the whole atmosphere, to be tractable. So that means you might have grid boxes that are 100 kilometers on a side, and different labs have treated this differently. In some, the vertical, instead of being height, it might be based on level sets of pressure, for example. And so I'm trying to motivate that many climate climate models differ, and some of the ways that they differ, even if all the scientific assumptions are the same, which sometimes a disjoint set of processes are modeled among different climate models, there's still the issue of how to discretize. And discretization is one way to try to solve a very hard problem, which is this issue of scale interactions. You have things happening at drastically different scales in time and space. So to understand climate, you really need to understand clouds. Well, to understand clouds, you need to look at how raindrops condense around particles in the atmosphere, which is happens very quickly and at a very small resolution, whereas the ocean is enormous and circulates on the order of hundreds of years. So these are some of the challenges. And this is just to give you a sense of where the climate model prediction data is coming from. So the first climate model was actually at Princeton starting in 1969. And each of these laboratories, you know, there's a couple in the US, Germany has a few, there's a couple in Japan. Each of these is a big laboratory that has been working on climate modeling for about 30 years and has their own big software system that is running their own climate model simulation. And all of these, about 20 of them, feed into informing this UN panel, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, to make climate change predictions for which they won the Nobel Peace Prize. And their next set of predictions and assessment, climate change assessment report, is going to be due in 2013. So the hope is that people that want to work on collaborations to improve these predictions may have some impact on that report. So let's look at the data, and hopefully you can see these thin lines. And before I explain what the variable is, this is just, for now, a variable predicted by climate models. But there's high variance in the predictions of the climate model. So for those of you that can't see, there are some little thin curves up here, some down here, even when you're predicting on the past. And remember, they're not data-driven, so it's valid to run them on the past. Blue is the observable for the observed value of the variable, and red is the average over model predictions, which does a better job than any one model at matching the observations, even though it doesn't do that great. So what is this particular variable that I'm plotting here? It's global mean temperature anomaly. So a temperature anomaly is the difference in the raw temperature, so the observed temperature, from the temperature at the same location at some benchmark time in the past. So climate scientists study these because they have less variance when you average them over multiple locations. So, for example, today it's 20 degrees colder in New Jersey, say, than in San Diego. So if I were to average temperatures over multiple locations, I might expect pretty high variance. But the difference in temperature today in New Jersey from the same calendar day in 1960 in New Jersey might be, say, 1 degree. And the difference in temperature in San Diego between today and that same fixed day in 1960 might be, say, 2 degrees. And now, when we average those over multiple locations, we'll have lower variance. Now, a global mean temperature anomaly is averaged, a global annual mean temperature anomaly is averaged over many, many geographical locations and many, many times of year to just give me one value per for the globe per year. I also have some bonus slides, I don't know if I'll get to them, showing zooming down over continents, Africa, North America, and Europe, where the variances increase even more because you're not averaging over as many geographical locations. And I also have data zooming down at a monthly level, which has much higher variance. So the other thing I wanted to point out is these climate simulations, we can run them out into the future. So here's climate model simulations out into 2098. And, of course, the observed value of global mean temperature anomaly stops around 2009 in this case. And for those of you that can't see in the back, we have some trajectories of the climate models that fan out quite a bit. And so even though the mean did an okay job in the past, it starts to diverge from the various climate model predictions, so it's unclear whether the mean would be a good predictor in the future. So this project I worked on called Tracking Climate Models, we were basically faced with realizations coming out of climate science that over time, no one climate model is the best predictor, and really the average prediction is better than any fixed climate model. And so the IPCC held an expert meeting on how to combine model predictions, and we actually presented our preliminary work there. So the idea is, how can we predict future climates? And this is not a simple time series prediction problem, right, where you look at a certain variable in the past and try to predict it in the future, because we still want to take into account the climate model predictions, right? A lot of time and energy has gone into them, and also they're physical models, so they may lend some help to the prediction task just due to the inertia of some of the physical laws. So we actually got a best paper for our initial application here, and this is an application of an online learning algorithm to track a set of experts that we're going to instantiate as climate models. And so online learning is part of my thrust on learning from data streams, so I'm just going to spend a little while just motivating that to you and describing the algorithm and then show how it was applied. So here you're learning from infinite data streams in a supervised setting. So all the data is labeled, but typically before you look at the label, you as the algorithm will make a prediction on the current point. And that way you can compute a prediction loss, which penalizes your prediction with respect to the true label. I'm leaving this general because this can be instantiated however you want, depending on what the classification or regression task is. But the algorithm then would be wise to update its hypothesis taking into account that loss. So as I mentioned, via this prediction loss function, these algorithms can be very modular because you can use it to encode different tasks. In our task, where it's regression, it's just the squared difference between the predicted and observed temperature. Yeah?
But you don't, you cannot update the models, right? Even if you see that the model is not acting similar.
Yeah,
to
we don't push
label.
It back. It's not like ensemble Kalman filtering. Yeah.
You cannot change
right.
it.
Right. In fact, these, I'll get to it in a second, but all the performance guarantees make no assumptions on the models. So they could even be sort of these black box adversarial models. And similarly with the data, we make no assumptions on the data, not even IID. And in fact, all performance guarantees hold even if the data is generated adversarially by someone that's actually watching what we make in terms of predictions. Given that there's no distributional assumptions, then we judge algorithms with relative performance guarantees, right? We can't prove generalization error bounds because we're not in the IID setting, but we compare, the thing to bound is called regret, which is the difference in cumulative prediction loss that your algorithm achieves, so cumulative over, say, a stream of observations, with respect to some algorithm within some comparator class that is optimal in hindsight with respect to the observation. This is also called the universal prediction setting from information theory. So the kinds of algorithms that we're going to consider predict informed by a set of experts. And as I just mentioned, these experts are black boxes. We make no assumptions about how good that they are at predicting. But we're simply going to start with the uniform distribution over experts and predict as a weighted average of the experts' predictions but update that weighting over time based on how the experts are performing for the task. So whatever your loss is for the problem, and this is just a function of the expert's current prediction and the current observation, and I mentioned in the climate model task it's just the squared difference between predicted and observed, then you can certainly just do Bayesian updating. So you can penalize experts that have high loss, and then this, then just renormalize the distribution. So I just quickly wanted to mention that this has a long history, these multiplicative updates algorithms, even going back to work in electrical engineering, the Lempel-Ziv algorithm. But if you have data that changes over time, this is not necessarily the best update, right? Because if you start with a uniform distribution, you'll slowly put a lot more mass over an expert that's currently predicting well, but all the other experts' weights will go down to zero at an exponential rate. So if the regime changes, suddenly observations become different and another expert would be a better predictor, its weight will be very close to zero, and it'll be hard for you to build back weight on that expert. So let's talk about a different model for updating this weighting over experts. I'm still going to predict as a weighted average over experts. So we can use a hidden Markov model for this. So a hidden Markov model is a graphical model where nodes are random variables and edges are conditional probabilities. This hidden Markov model is more general than you may have seen before because we allow arbitrary dependencies between observations. But this just makes it more general. So here, the hidden variable is the identity of which expert, or in our setting, climate model, is currently the best predictor. Now, we're not going to predict only with the best predictor's prediction. We're still going to predict with respect to an average. But our modeling assumption is that there's always one that's currently the best. So now, if you just do Bayesian updating on this HMM, this generalized HMM, you yield a family of online learning algorithms. So the Bayesian update here now just needs to condition over the previous best expert and do the same update, but you also have to take into account the transition dynamics. So what should the transition dynamics be? So you could first consider the identity matrix, and then we'd get back to the Bayesian update that I had before. Essentially, one expert is always going to be the best, and you don't model switching. But if you do want to model switching between which expert is currently the best, Herbster and Warmoth introduced an algorithm called fixed share, where you take the identity and subtract from the diagonal some small fraction alpha. So essentially, the model is assuming that it's quite likely that if one expert was the best at time t, it will still be the best at time t plus 1. But with some small probability, alpha over the number of experts minus 1, it could switch to any of the other experts. So here's a transition dynamics that has 1 minus alpha on the diagonal and alpha over the number of experts minus 1 on the off diagonal to model switching. But what should this alpha be? So, you know, that's sort of your level of non-stationarity, or how bursty, how often you expect changes to occur among your observations. And so in some previous work, we had noticed empirically, and then we also proved, that the wrong setting of alpha for the data set that you were going to observe could actually lead to poor performance. So then we proposed an algorithm where you simply lay down a bunch of copies of the original HMM, but each running with a different value of that alpha parameter. That's just a parameter that varies between 0 and 1. And now, so these are meta-experts, and I'm going to simultaneously learn the best value of the parameter alpha while I'm performing the learning task. So these would be the climate models. Each of them would have their weights updated using the Bayesian update of the HMM, but parameterized by a different value of alpha. And here we'd be running the standard Bayesian updating to learn the best fixed value of the parameter alpha. So usually on this slide, people ask me, why don't you learn the best switching value of the parameter alpha? And certainly you could increase this hierarchy up ad infinitum, but you essentially get diminishing returns. We can already prove something strong without doing that. And also when you increase model complexity, then you could suffer from overfitting typically. So this suffices to show that if we consider regret with respect to the same algorithm, fixed share, which is that HMM parameterized by alpha, so regret with respect to the HMM using the hindsight cumulative regret optimal value of that parameter, regret can be linear for the existing algorithms. This lower bound is sequence dependent, but it can be linear. But using our algorithm allows us to only suffer logarithmic regret. And we also tell you how to discretize alpha to be optimal with respect to the bound, which requires knowing the desired sequence length. But even if you just choose a uniform discretization, it'll perform well in practice. So let me explain the application. I've already essentially said how we apply it. experts are climate models, and the loss function is the squared difference between predicted and observed temperature. So URLs are in the journal paper about this, but there's an archive where you can get IPCC climate model predictions up into the future. For historical experiments, we ran on observed temperature values from NASA. But we also wanted to run future simulations. So, of course, there's no observations in the future. So, suggested by the climate scientists, we ran with what's called the perfect model assumption. So, essentially, you have your 20 climate models. You clamp one, say the ICE model, and say, that's actually the observations. And now I'm just going to train on the ensemble of the remaining 19. Of course, you have to do this multiple times, right, to make sure that your methodology works. And then we also ran regional experiments where we would consider latitude-longitude grid boxes corresponding with these continents. And then we also ran on annual and monthly timescales and some future simulations there as well. So just to give you a qualitative taste of our results, here are some learning curves for a future simulation in the global annual experiment, where blue is the worst expert at predicting the climate model that has been clamped to be the observations. And here we zoom in on the bottom, on deleting this curve and just zooming in on the y-axis. Red is the average over model predictions, which was the benchmark, the state of the art to beat. Green was the best out of the remaining 19 models at predicting the model that had been chosen for observations. And black is the algorithm. But let me go through some of the tables. So for the global annual experiment, we also compared with a batch method, which did pretty well also. And the benchmark to beat is the average prediction, because that's what the climate scientists were using. Interestingly, on the historical experiment, there was a best climate model. But apparently, this doesn't contradict the climate scientists' claims, because it's only best on global mean temperature. If you go to predict carbon dioxide, it might be a different climate model that's best. And certainly, this effect disappeared when we zoomed down on geographical regions. Right, and so as we zoom down on... Okay, so I guess there was a best climate model for Africa, but I don't think it was the same. So what happens as you zoom on to a geographical region, the data itself has more variance because it's averaged over less geographical regions. And then as you go from annual to monthly, the data also has more variance. And this is already subtracting out seasonality effects. So all the methods get more variance as we go from the last slide to this slide and as we go from these tables to that table. But it does seem like an online learning technique has an advantage over a batch technique, which treats all past data uniformly.
Why did linear regression do so poorly there? You have double stars.
Oh, yeah. It just didn't do very well. I had double stars that if we remove the first data set, we can get it down to 4 points. The first data point, we can get it down to 4 points something. But that would be kind of an unfair comparison. So, yeah, it didn't do that well.
What was the first point? Some...
Well, okay, so what we have to do...
I think there's some inside. No?
Well, okay, my point is, so linear regression, right? You can't even run that on... So you need to have... So we're in a 19-dimensional space, so you need to have at least 19 training points. So this is... these are averaged over... these are averaged over every observation point, but linear regression, I can't run it at all until I've seen 20 points. So I would expect it to be kind of bad also, even once you have exactly 20 points. And so at the next point, the variance went down, but still not enough. And actually just a quick word about this evaluation setting. This evaluation setting, even for the batch method, is the following. Oh, and here it actually did okay on one of the future simulations. This evaluation method is that you have prediction loss at every observation, and then that's averaged over time. The batch method is allowed to train on all the observations since the beginning of time, whereas the online method is performing in the online setting. And I just want to mention there's a paper by Blum, Kalai, and Langford called Beating the Holdout that compares this online style of evaluation, which is called progressive validation, comparing it to just standard holdout error, both k-fold and leave one out cross-validation. So I guess I'll just talk about related future work. So spend a slide on climate informatics and also generally in machine learning. So what I've been doing so far is actually just working at a macro level where you don't look under the hood of any particular climate model. You just try to combine the predictions of the ensemble. And there is some interesting future work. Of course, the climate scientists just want to take our algorithms and run them on a bunch of different data types, and that'll be very interesting to them. We can also maybe richen the model by adding in spatial transition dynamics. Maybe one climate model is better at predicting in a geographical location than another one. One thing that has frustrated me about this work, and it may have been frustrating to you as well, is that in order to run our algorithm, we need observations. And that's because it's open in machine learning to do semi or unsupervised learning with experts. It's going to be pretty impossible to prove anything about unsupervised learning with experts without some assumptions, however. But the nice thing about working with people that have a practical application is that there are some assumptions that are already being used in practice, and those assumptions may give us traction for the design of theoretically justified algorithms. So another goal is to sort of build up the theoretical foundations within which we can design principled machine learning algorithms for climate. Also, we actually don't need real-time predictions, so we might as well explore all the literature on batch machine learning and compare and contrast. What we've seen so far is that an online learning algorithm is doing better than the straw man batch algorithm that we use, and it might be because the data is time-varying, so you would sort of want to forget about the past in order to predict the future. So transductive regression is something that I'd be interested in applying, where we just need predictions, say, in the year 2050 and 2100. We don't need to fit the whole temperature function into the future. However, most analyses assume that your unlabeled data set is drawn from the same distribution as your labeled data set, and in our case, we actually have disjoint support. All our data is from the past, and all our unlabeled data is from the future. So also, I'm excited to work with the NASA climate modelers on their climate model. So one thing that they've proposed is this issue of climate model parameterization. And this is about resolving scale interactions. So as I said, a cloud model has to compute at a very small scale. And so even in a single grid box that's 100 kilometers cubed, when you run the cloud simulation, you're running at a much smaller spatial resolution. And it would be intractable to run the cloud model everywhere within a grid box. So essentially, given that a cloud model simulation has been run to provide the output values, say, rainfall or humidity at a few certain locations in the grid box, what should the one number of rainfall and the number for humidity be for the entire grid box? So there might be some things we can use, such as kernel regression or multi-scale data techniques coming out of, data mining and machine learning. I've started to realize, although I don't actually know if this is a technical term, and it might exist in some other fields, and if anyone has feedback on that, I'd be interested. But really what we want are models that are both physical, mathematical models, but also harness data, so that are somehow hybrid between the two. Climate scientists are not going to speak to us if we try to replace climate models with data-driven models. But secondly, as I mentioned before, the fact that we have some real physics to rely on gives us some predictability, some inertia to the system, and so we should harness that. Finally, there are a lot of other open problems that climate modelers are interested in, such as how to calibrate or compare climate models in a principled manner. And I just wanted to give a plug for this workshop. If you're interested, especially since you're in the area, you should just come attend. And the nice thing is we're going to do breakout sessions where climate modelers will pose challenge problems, and we can all brainstorm about solutions, and you might get a collaboration out of it. Actually, there's a lot of climate scientists in the New York area. I guess I'll try to go quickly through this, but my main thrust within the rest of machine learning is, as I said, this exciting intersection between learning from data streams and learning from raw or unlabeled data. And so I really want to push on online clustering, where you're clustering infinite data streams. But even the evaluation frameworks need to change, because generally you're making real-time predictions, and it's not okay to just stop at a certain point and evaluate your algorithm. So I do actually have some very hot-off-the-press work that we just submitted to a recent conference deadline on online clustering with experts, where the experts are clustering algorithms, and we use approximations to the k-means objective instead of loss. A regression version, as I mentioned, would be applicable to climate informatics, however. Finally, I also have several ongoing collaborations on privacy, one of them with several people in the room, on privacy-preserving constrained optimization, or LP. But, you know, now that we've sort of already have a story for empirical risk minimization algorithms, there's, you know, a wide variety of other things that we want to do in machine learning, such as k-nearest neighbor, that don't fall into that framework. I have several open interests within active learning as well, and I'm also always open to exciting new collaborations. So I just wanted to thank you and my students and postdocs, and thank Tina for inviting me.
Thank you. Any questions?
You said that batch learning algorithms are kind of fail because of the transitions in the data, actually, data changes. Have you tried dynamic models, switching dynamic linear systems?
I have only tried what I showed, and I want to try more things. But I would like to find out from you what reference you're talking about. Recently, someone has been proposing ensemble Kalman filters. I don't know if that falls under those categories.
That does, but it's a general term for dynamic models that switch between each one of them, and they are all linear models. So based on the data, you can switch from this model to the other.
Okay, but we can't make an assumption that the climate models are linear models.
Of course, that approximation is.
What's nice about this framework is that it doesn't make any assumption about the climate models, and since they're a huge mess under the hood, it wouldn't make sense. Like, so for example, we can't use boosting, right? These are not decision stumps, you know. But I might jot down what the reference from you afterwards.
Any other questions?
Yeah, I have one question. I was wondering about, you mentioned for the switching you were doing sort of Bayesian thing with hidden Markov models.
Right.
I'm wondering, how does that relate to the standard technique that they use where they just limit how low the weights can get in a lot of these switching algorithms?
What I like about this is that this is essentially parameter free. Because when you impose a threshold or a discount factor, that's also a parameter. And generally in that case, you can always think of a bad data observation sequence for any choice of that parameter. But, I mean, it might work okay in practice.
So, Claire, there's another interesting application of the modeling. At the Center of Excellence in Homeland Security established at Rutgers in data analysis, we're looking at simulation and modeling of commerce versus security trade-offs. So there's a lot of discrete event modeling that gets applied in that area, and it'd be interesting to look. There are different models being applied to the same problem. It'd be interesting to look at that as a possible domains to apply this.
Right, so the nice thing about these kinds of algorithms, anytime you have a bunch of people arguing about what algorithm you should apply to a problem, you could just stop arguing, throw them in the bag as experts, and run this algorithm on top, and it'll select out and perform almost as well as the best algorithm. But also, maybe what you were referring to also, I hope, because I'm looking for related technology, relates to hybrid models. So if you already have some physical or mathematical models of the economics and you're wanting to assimilate or incorporate data to really speed up the discovery, then I'm interested in, you know, how you're answering those questions and any related work. Because I think that this kind of thing exists somewhere. I think it exists at least in fluid dynamics to some extent. But and this should be a very general technology to incorporate data with physical models.
Well, the straightforward way is to use the data to set the initial
parameters that these things usually have, right? The physics-based models. Usually there's some initial parameters they have to set.
I think they're already doing that.
Really, they are? Okay.
But, and actually, in those fan-out graphs, they all start with the same initial conditions, and they don't take different assumptions as to... So the external forcings of climate are things like, what would happen if we chopped down all the rainforests or drained the ocean? They're not using different input assumptions to their models, but then they still get that crazy drift.
But they're, okay, they initialize with data, but they're not using data along the way, right?
Right, well,
that means, right? Hybrid model.
Right. Unfortunately, they're not supposed to be. At least I didn't assume that they were. However, the first time I gave this slide in a machine learning workshop, someone stood up at the back and said, hey, you said these aren't data-driven? How come suddenly, you know, they're all tightly bunched and then suddenly they diverge in the future? And they're not data-driven in the machine learning way that they're explicitly automatically trained on data. However, unfortunately, due to, you know, politics and scientific competition, apparently what happens is if they run on the past and they can compare to the past data, they might scratch their head and say, oh, maybe we should add a component model that models the Indian Ocean better, for example.
Right.
So it's, I would like a more clear picture from each climate model to what extent any data has been used in the loop, you know, because it'll help our algorithms. But it's hard to say.
I have one. You compared assuming one of them is the best algorithm for the future predictions.
Yeah.
But in the end, do you get a model which predicts the future best, or can you decide which one?
No one can predict the future. All we can do is compare methodologies. But we can just show that we do a better job of tracking what are supposed to be the observations than the existing methods.
So in the end, when you run with the previous data, and in the end, can you have a model which predicts the future from now, which you think that it is the best of them, best of all these combinations?
I don't understand your question. I can't predict the future. I mean, anyone can make predictions, but I can't guarantee that my predictions are good. All I can do is verify on past data and compare methodologies, or verify in future simulations that it's the better methodology in that simulation.
Could you simulate that, train on models, for example, up to 2009, using that data and see how well they predict on the data from the last 2 years?
Yeah, so one thing that we're adding now...
lock down models today and evaluate them all in a year from now.
So one thing that we also did to compare linear regression with our technique was exactly that. We say up until some date in the past, say 1950, it's only train. And then after that, it's only test. So we just run the model predictively, and we don't update its weights. And I don't know actually if I have that plot. Using that methodology, because I thought that was more fair as a batch comparison with linear regression, and we also had significant advantages with respect to linear regression doing that. So you just say, I only train... you know, run in that online learning training mode up until a certain time in the past, and then I just test on the data up until the present. And you can also vary that value, that threshold between train and test.
By how much did you beat the logistic regression?
I don't remember, actually. I don't know if I have the... I don't have that plot, but I'll check the journal paper and let you know. But it was marked. Yeah.
Going back to the online clustering problem.
Yes.
Did you try mini batches?
Mini batches?
Yeah.
I haven't heard of that. But it was a divide and conquer thing. So we divided it into batches. It's something that would only work in the finite streaming setting, not the online streaming setting. So we just divide the stream into batches. And then for each batch, we run batch clustering, and we output a set of centers. It's actually A times K centers. And then the union of all the centers output from each of those calls is fed into another clustering algorithm. But that's the protocol. That's the framework due to Guha.
Okay.
we just extended the analysis and then plugged in those batch algorithms that we provided.
Thank you.
Okay.